Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Rogue Angel by Alex Archer. Rogue Angel number 28. Restless Soul. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Thomas Keegan, Tony Nam, Terrence Aselford, Joe Brack, James Konacek, Tim Carlin, Christopher Sheeran, Michael John Casey, Richard Rowan, Jeff Allen, Danny Gavigan, Ken Jackson, Scott McCormick, Mort Shelby, Alyssa Wilmoth, Dolores King-Williams, and David Coyne.
Prologue. Vietnam, July 1966. At first, he hadn't minded the sound of the place. He was Bronx born and raised, and the noises of the Vietnam jungle were an interesting oddity and an almost welcome change from the frequent sirens and ever-present racket of traffic back home. It was all a pleasant diversion from orders barked by commanding officers and the grumbles of the men in his rifle company. He even liked the smell. But that was more months ago than he cared to count. Now the sounds blurred into a hellish cacophony that he had to pick through to listen for branches snapping, footfalls that weren't from his men, the metallic click of machine guns and rifles ready to fire. Now the place reeked of mud and rotting leaves, of things his imagination wasn't vivid or brave enough to picture, and sometimes of decomposing bodies that neither side had retrieved. Sergeant Gary Thompson had learned to hate summer and the jungle. He hated the trails tangled with plants that grabbed at his heavy pack and all his weapons. He hated the sweat running down his face as plentiful as rain. He hated the fear twisting in his gut that someone was hiding around the next tree ready to kill him. He hated everything about Vietnam and the goddamn war that the politicians in the States wouldn't call a war. A police action, was that the latest term? He hated the leeches most of all. He knew that they were clinging to him now. They were somehow always able to find their way up his pants and under his sleeves, into his boots, so they could gorge themselves on his sweet American blood. He'd led his men through brackish ponds and across streams and along a riverbank that morning and well into the afternoon, so there would be leeches on everyone. He wanted to strip and pull the leeches off, but that would have to wait. There was another 3 hours or so left of what passed for daylight. The canopy was thick, and not much sun was getting through. He had his orders to reach the firebase before dark and regroup with the rest of the platoon.
Sarge?
Gary scowled at the fact that someone had broken the relative silence. He turned to Private Wallum, a gangly hawk-nosed Texan who was pointing to just north of the trail. A body, mostly bones and scraps of dirty cloth, lay under a big fern.
It's one of theirs, Sarge. See? You can tell by the boots. Huh, wonder if we got him or the jungle did. I guess it doesn't matter. As long as it's one of theirs, right?
Gary shut out the rest of Wallum's words and fixed his eyes on the body, angry with himself that he hadn't spotted it. Not that it was all that interesting or all that important, but nothing used to get past him. He'd set himself as point man for the patrol. The squad leader wasn't supposed to walk point. He was supposed to take the second position. But Gary thought he had the keenest, most experienced eyes, and he wanted to be up front. There was just too much green. He'd spent too many days in the jungle, and there were all those leeches attached to his flesh, distracting him. A good point man should have seen the body and not let anything distract him. What else had he missed, he wondered. Gary thought about the words of President Lyndon Johnson.
War is always the same. It is young men dying in the fullness of their promise. It is trying to kill a man that you do not even know well enough to hate. Therefore, to know war is to know that there is still madness in this world.
The quote had stayed with him because Gary was sure he was going mad. Johnson had said the words 6 months earlier, back in January, shortly before Operation Masher, a large-scale search-and-destroy operation against North Vietnamese troop encampments began. Johnson had then changed the name to Operation White Wing, which didn't sound quite so aggressive. Gary and his men were a part of it, in the Bong Son Plain near the coast. A little more than 200 American soldiers had died, but almost six times that many North Vietnamese. Gary thought maybe he'd get to go home after it ended, but his sergeant was one of those Americans killed, and he was assigned another tour, promoted to E5, and given his rifle squad of 10 to lead. The leeches would get some more of his sweet American blood. Gary looked over the corpse. Sometimes the enemy rigged tripwires and explosives around bodies.
Leave it alone. Keep moving.
He checked his compass. West, definitely. They were humping due west on an established trail. It took too much effort to hack straight through the jungle. Everything grew too tight. He'd look at the map again in another few minutes. They were hard to read, the maps. He navigated mostly by gut instinct and the compass. The constant buzz of insects was annoying, but ultimately comforting. The insects rarely quieted. They didn't seem to mind the presence of soldiers from either side. When they did go quiet, that was when fear seriously twisted in his gut. God, but he wanted to go home. That was a bomb, Gary knew, from a B-52. The planes carried up to 100, dropping them from as high as 6 miles up. The U.S. regularly bombed North Vietnam and lately had been hitting oil depots around Hanoi and Haiphong. Gary had read somewhere that Senator Robert F. Kennedy had criticized the president for the bombing, saying the country was heading down
a road from which there is no turning back, a road that leads to catastrophe for all mankind.
As far as Gary was concerned, there'd been no turning back since the U.S. brought the first plane load of soldiers. He wished they'd bomb the whole damn country into oblivion so he could go home. Wallum started to speak again, but Gary cut him off with a quick chopping motion of his hand. Between the sounds of marching and insects buzzing, he'd heard something else, a spitting sound, a sustained whisper that he recognized as machine gun fire. It wasn't terribly close, but he prayed it didn't come closer. He held his breath and sensed that his men were doing the same, and he gripped the stock of his rifle tighter. He didn't want to engage any Viet Cong, but those were part of his orders. Dispatch any VC patrols on the way to the firebase. Four or five machine guns, he guessed, from the bursts. He couldn't tell which side was doing the shooting. Didn't matter, did it? The enemy was involved, to be sure.
Move out!
Gary picked up the pace. His legs ached with the punishment of too many miles, but he forced the pain to the back of his mind. Just another hour, two at the outside, to reach the firebase. Maybe he should call for a 5-minute rest, get rid of some of the leeches. Then it would be easier to press on to the base so they could regroup with the others, get rid of more of the leeches, sleep before falling out the next day on some new asinine mission the higher-ups had concocted. He cut through a particularly tight weave of trees where the trail narrowed, led them through a stretch of marsh, and was just about ready to call for that blessed 5-minute rest when he spotted something that hadn't been marked on his map.
Sarge, what is it?
Sorry. Gary glared at Wallum, then turned back to what he'd seen. Right in front of them was a building of some sort. Definitely an old one. The jungle had practically swallowed it. Vines were thick on the columns and what was left of the walls. Most of the stone was stained green, but there were patches of white here and there, and he could see worn symbols that he suspected had once stood out quite prominently.
Maybe a shrine?
The country certainly had enough of them. They were Buddhist, right? They worshipped the smiling fat guy with the bald head, he thought. Almost half of the building looked intact, and there was an opening midway down the greenish stone. The door, if there had been one, had been eaten away by time and the jungle, and the opening that was left looked like the yawning mouth of a serpent. They probably had an hour or so left to get to the fire base if he wasn't off course. Maybe a little more than that. Maybe two at the very outside, he was sure. He knew he shouldn't take the time to investigate the place, but God, his feet and legs ached from all that walking. And the wide-open stone mouth beckoned. He edged forward, straight toward the opening, gesturing for Wallum to come behind him. His curiosity tugged him, but it was also his responsibility to make sure no enemy soldiers were hiding inside. Checking would just be following orders. He held up his fist for his men to stop and wait. Then he stepped through the serpent's mouth. His mouth dropped open. Wallum poked his head inside. He stretched to see over Gary's shoulder.
Holy spit! Sweet Mary, Mother of God!
Gary was so surprised that he didn't even frown at Wallum for speaking. Sunlight was shining through a sizable hole in the roof, illuminating gold figurines, several of Buddha with emeralds set in his earlobes and where his belly button would be. There were pieces of ivory, bowls that he figured might have some sort of religious significance because they were so delicate and beautifully painted, jade and coral carvings, and more. It was too much for him to take in. His gaze flitted from one piece to the next, pausing on a pair of jade koi with intertwined tails, before settling on a small Buddha with jewels draped around its neck. The light dimmed, as if the sun was behind a cloud, plunging everything into shadows. Still, he could see well enough. There was a bird the size of his hand, probably carved from ivory, perched on a shiny black pedestal. It made Gary think of Operation White Wing.
This is creepy.
Wallum held a covered bowl with dark symbols etched everywhere. He put it down and picked up a fist-sized jade turtle.
This is better.
The treasure didn't belong there. It didn't have the mossy green film of the jungle, nor any vines growing on it. And it was polished, as if it had just come from a temple or a museum. It had to have been put there fairly recently. Maybe by thieves, maybe by monks, who, fearing the invading Americans might destroy their precious antiquities, moved them to the middle of nowhere. Would it hurt to take some of the smaller pieces? There were things that would easily fit in pockets and packs. The jewels draped around the Buddha alone would buy him a Mustang when he got back home. Hell with that, he could buy a house. Maybe get his mother one, too.
Sarge?
Gary didn't answer. He reached behind his back and eased his pack off, flipped it open and started filling the crannies with pendants and thumb-sized jade carvings, taking the small things that looked the most valuable. There was a ring with a diamond in the shape of a sunflower seed. He'd give it to his girl as an engagement ring when he popped the question after he got back home. He looped a string of gold beads around his neck. They felt heavy and cold, but they quickly warmed against his skin. After only a moment's hesitation, Wallum joined in the looting, snatching the ivory bird first and discovering the wings detached, which made it easier to fit in his pack.
What about the rest of the men? Should they come in, Sarge? There's enough for everybody.
Gary didn't reply. He was filling his pockets with anything that fit, shoving jade and silver rings on his fingers as he went. His mind raced to figure out how to take one of the golden Buddhas. At first, Gary thought the sound was another distant bomb, but it was followed by the patter of rain, some of which found its way inside. Real thunder. That explained the light slipping away on him. Storms sprang up quickly in Vietnam. The frequent rains were proverbial mixed blessings. They cooled the men off, but they added time to any mission. And worse, the rain smeared all the greens together and made it more difficult to see the enemy.
God damn it.
It would take them longer to reach the firebase now, slogging along a muddy trail through a wet jungle, probably slowed a little bit more by the weight of the treasure. A good weight, he thought. The only good thing about this godforsaken country was this room full of treasure.
Get Sandusky and Moore. Mitchell and Everett and Seeger, too, for starters. Those guys go first. Tell them all to load up whatever they can. Everybody can take a turn.
Some part of Gary knew he shouldn't be doing this, and he knew he'd have a hell of a time trying to get the stuff back home. But he just couldn't get past all the gold.
I'll take it home. I'll find a way.
Gary was nothing if not resourceful. Besides, his orders never said he couldn't pick up abandoned treasure. In fact, his orders never mentioned treasure at all. As if reading his mind, Wallum spoke up.
This ain't stealing, Sarge. This stuff is just...
lying around. Sandusky and Moore for starters.
They were on their second tour, too, and deserved something for it. Moore, the radio man, had twin boys who'd just turned three. Wallum managed to stuff the tail-touching koi into his pack after taking out some probably necessary supplies. Gary tried to heft one of the small Buddha statues and discovered it was made of solid gold.
Then the rest. There's enough for everybody.
We'll take it all, Sarge. The slopeheads just left us unattended. Maybe the owners are dead. It's all ours and all
it... We can't take it all. There's too much. We'll only get out of here with some of it.
A king's ransom.
Gotta get going. Gotta get to the firebase. Probably have to clear some ground there tomorrow for a helicopter pad. Gotta get there before dark.
Hey! Moore! Sandusky! Get in here! In a few minutes, Sarge? Give us a few more minutes. It'd only be fair for everyone to get something.
The light turned gray as the rain pelted through the roof onto the stone and golden statues, but not so dim that the golden statues couldn't be seen.
Woo-hoo!
Moore brushed by Gary. Sandusky stopped in the opening and gaped.
Fort Knox! Load up! Son of a...
More than satisfied with his share of the haul, Gary stepped out into the downpour. He tipped his head back to let the rain wash the sweat off. His pack felt heavier, and his pockets bulged. He fought the grin that spread across his face and lost.
Woo!
He wished he could take one of those Buddhas.
Grab fast and move out!
No use looking at his map in this dreary muck. He'd rely on the compass and his good instinct. Lightning flashed.
Shit!
Suddenly, mud spat up around his feet.
Ah! God!
He fell as hot fire slammed into his legs.
Wallum! Company! Moore, get out here! We got...
Company. Such beautiful company you are, Anya Creed. And I am very much enjoying the pleasures of it.
Luar Taro stood behind Anya at the sliding glass door and slid his fingers through her silky chestnut hair. She leaned against him, happily discovering he hadn't put on a shirt. At 5'10", Anya was nearly his height.
And I am so very much enjoying this vacation, Luar Taro.
Lu, please.
He leaned around her and softly kissed her cheek.
How many times do I have to ask you to call me Lu? It's what my family calls me. And it's much easier for you to pronounce.
Lu. Lu, Lu, Lu. This vacation was long overdue.
I wish it could go on forever, Anya, this vacation.
But we've only got another 4 days.
Maybe we should leave this bungalow and see a bit of the countryside. We didn't travel halfway around the world to go to Thailand to spend all our time in bed.
Speak for yourself.
Anya edged away and pressed herself against the glass door. It was cool with the rain that had blotted out the July sun. She followed a rivulet with her finger as it slithered down the pane. The patter was gentle, like his breath on her shoulder, and it made the green of the trees beyond their cabin more intense. They'd found this resort on the internet, though there were no public internet connections available in the lodge or any of the cabins. Wireless service didn't exist here. Neither were there television sets, nor telephones, save an old rotary one in the office. With that, they had both immediately agreed on the place, as they could keep the world at bay for a while. Anya had been in South America, filming a segment for Chasing History's Monsters on the fossils of ancient penguin-like creatures that had been discovered in the mountains. She'd met Luartaro Agustin at one of the dig sites there. He was charming and smart, and when he'd surprised her by suggesting that they spend some more time together, she'd hesitated only a moment. She desperately needed time off, from the show, from her life, from everything. So right there in his lavish office, she'd twirled the huge globe that took up most of one corner, closed her eyes, and pointed her finger. Luartaro had come over to see where her finger had landed. Northern Thailand. She'd surprised him by walking over to his immense oak desk and calling the airline to make a reservation. For two. As she watched the rain, she thought that perhaps Luartaro had fallen in love with her, though he wisely hadn't said the words. Would those words frighten her away? Did she love him? Not yet, but perhaps, with time. She'd only known him a handful of days before they'd recklessly packed their bags and flown here. She'd learned through difficult circumstances that life was terribly short, and she decided to take a chance on joy for once. Could she love him? Perhaps, if she let herself. The attraction, physical and otherwise, was strong. She watched the way the rain distorted his handsome reflection. He had a rugged face weathered by long days in the sun, a shock of black hair with the faintest hints of silver at the temples, broad shoulders and considerable muscles from years spent digging at sites throughout the mountains and foothills of South America. In addition to being an archaeologist, he taught at a college during the regular academic year, had written 3 textbooks, and was fluent in 6 languages. Though, unfortunately, Thai was not one of them. They had a lot in common. Perhaps she was reading too much into his actions. After all, he knew very little about her, which was a plus, as far as she was concerned. He didn't know that danger too often surrounded her, and that some mystic force seemed to have chosen her to battle evil. She hadn't told him that she was an orphan with little sense of real connection to people, nor had she told him, and never intended to, that on a whim she could summon Joan of Arc's sword from some nether dimension to fight whatever malignant force had crossed her path. Because of the sword and her risky life, she never allowed herself to become too attached to people. She had Rue and Garin, but they were associated with the sword. Rue claiming they had witnessed Joan's horrific death and had existed in a kind of decadent limbo in the centuries since. Luartaro was different. Like so many others, he wasn't a part of that life. Normally, she would have kept her emotions in check, but there was something special about him. She felt things for him that she hadn't intended.
And what does he think of me? Does he consider me merely a television personality with a flair for archaeology? Or am I just another woman who has quickly succumbed to his boyish grin?
She watched his reflection in the window again. He had moved close enough that he was stroking her hair again, but he too was staring out at the rain and the mountains beyond. The view was the reason she was paying 800 baht a night for their cabin, 4 times what the average room cost. It was more lavishly furnished than most of the other accommodations at the lodge. It even had its own bath and shower. But best of all, it offered an incredible view of the lush countryside. Beyond the sliding glass doors was the path that led to the swimming hole, and another that wound its way to the small restaurant that served only native Thai dishes. The rain was slowly turning those paths into mud slicks. In the distance, the mountains that ringed the place disappeared into the gloom. The area had long been considered a land of exile because it was largely inaccessible. But tourists had eventually found the place, and buses and rental cars brought them in from larger cities. She and Luartaro had opted for a bus, the seats of which had not been very well padded. Mae Hung Sun claimed a hot spring, small and large crystal clear streams, and a magnificent cape, none of which Anya had seen. There was an elaborate Buddhist temple nearby, so the brochures said, and a tribe where the women elongated their necks with a series of rings. The Karen of the Padang.
I think we should do something touristy. Maybe we could take an elephant ride or do some mountain biking. The pamphlets say they have meditation classes in the mornings, rafting, and...
If you want to venture outside, why don't we visit the spirit cave?
Yeah.
A shiver raced down Anya's back, and she bit back a no before it could escape her lips. She couldn't explain what brought on the touch of dread, not to herself and not to Luar Taro. She could just claim that exploring a cave was too close to her real life as an archaeologist. That wasn't too far from the truth. She hadn't planned to let real life interfere with this long overdue vacation. She shook her head and turned away from the window. He wrapped his arms around her and held her close. He couldn't see the sour, conflicted expression on her face.
I saw a flyer about it in the lobby, a spirit cave. And I remember it was also mentioned on the internet when we found this place. Ancient coffins carved from trees, burial grounds inside mountains. There's such a cave less than a day's hike from here, and a guide takes you out in the morning. This area is known for its spectacular limestone caverns. There are hundreds of caves in the mountain ranges. It would be a shame not to visit at least one while you're so close, especially since you want to venture outside.
All right. A spirit cave. First thing tomorrow morning.
Wonderful! And we'll manage to make time for an elephant ride or some rafting before we leave. And maybe see the long-necked women and that big Buddhist temple. But for the moment, since it is raining...
He drew her toward the bed. At first glance, Anya couldn't tell whether the guide was 30 or 50. His eyes were bright, hinting at youth, but his skin was tanned and leathery from the sun, the wrinkles deep, especially at the edges of his eyes. Careworn, she judged his face. His black hair was thin and short, slicked with either sweat or oil, and his shoulders hunched slightly. He wore khaki pants, frayed and stained green and brown at the ankles, as if he'd never bothered to hem them, instead letting the ground and his heels wear the fabric down to a more suitable length. He had a faded polo shirt with an illustration of a gibbon on it, and over that, an unbuttoned short-sleeve shirt that was a riot of color, red, blue, green, with birds and flowers. He also wore a cord around his neck with a whistle dangling from it, and old black-and-white tennis shoes. He smiled broadly, nodded to their little group, and held his index finger to his chest.
Zakarat. Zakarat Taksin. Your guide to Namnot Cave.
Luar Taro reached for Anya's hand and swung it as if she was a child. He was smiling, too, obviously happy to be off to the Spirit Cave, as the pamphlet called it. His skin felt warm against hers, and she intertwined her fingers with his and reveled in his boyish attitude. With them were two other couples, one in their 20s, on an eco-honeymoon, they'd proudly announced. The other was a middle-aged Australian pair who were on their third trip to Thailand. Zakarat looked at everyone's feet.
Comfortable shoes all?
Comfortable shoes, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. 5-6 miles to the cave. 200 baht now, more later for extras. Not much more. This is one of the cheapest trips for tourists.
Here you go. The pamphlet says there'll be a charge to enter the cafe and for the raft.
Figures.
After passing out small water bottles, Zakarat led the way. He had a quick gait and was nimble, ducking under branches and stepping over ruts, and Anya put him closer to 30 for it. He chattered as he went, pointing first to the tops of the mountains and mentioning the mist. They were unlike other mountains she'd traipsed through, certainly unlike the familiar Rockies and the mountains she and Luar Taro had combed through for the ancient penguin remains. These peaks had been weathered away into twisted shapes and odd-looking knobs, largely covered by jungle. They were beautiful and ghost-like in the mist. She regretted not bringing her camera. Luar Taro wasn't taking as many pictures as she would have, or from what she deemed the proper angles. The path Zakarat took was wide and flat from the traffic of countless tourists. To the sides, stretched swaths of dark green moss, still shiny from yesterday's rain. Though practically everything was green, there were remarkable variations, Anya noted. Some of the leaves were so pale they appeared bleached bone white by the sun. Others were a deep green that looked like velvet. Shadows were thick near the ground where the large leaves reminded her of umbrellas. If there were patterns to the colors and light, she couldn't discern them. Everything was a swirl. Had someone taken a picture of the scenery and turned it into a jigsaw puzzle, it would be one of the most difficult ever to assemble, she thought. After a mile, Anya spotted a fence far to her left and a tilled field beyond. On the opposite side, the ground rose at a steep angle, and she wondered if there were caves beneath. A bit farther along, the Australian man drained his water bottle and looked at his watch.
My feet are hurting, Jenny.
His wife smiled sympathetically and pointed to a thin river that meandered out of the fields to their left. It widened as they kept walking, eventually paralleling the path, which had started to narrow.
More than 200 caves in Panmapa, in Meong Son alone.
Zakarat numbingly rattled off facts about their length in meters and feet with so little inflection that Anya guessed he'd been repeating his speech and leading tours so long that he was bored by it all.
This cave we go to, a most popular spot. Namlok Cave does not need climbing equipment. Easy on the feet, yes?
The path narrowed to the point they had to walk single file, and Anya noted faded signs tacked on trees written in Thai and English advertising a bird show. They'd obviously been posted years earlier, and she wondered if the show still continued, and if so, what it entailed. They came to a fork in the trail. Zakarat pointed to his right.
Temple! Doors available there too.
Through the mist, Anya could barely make out a large stone building with hints of ornate corners. The other course, the one they followed along the river, led to an old wooden gate that hung off its hinges and which they easily stepped through. The path became rougher, and gnarled tree roots poked through here and there. Zakarat slowed his pace and jabbed his finger at the largest roots.
Take care that you do not trip.
He nodded to another sign advertising a bird show.
Going out with a big group tomorrow night for the birds.
So there is a bird show. Ain't the birds out now?
This came from Jenny, who was looking up into the trees and alternately watching her husband. Apparently, she'd not noticed the other bird show signs.
Ah, there's a red one with black streaks on its wings. And there's another red one. So what's with the bird show? Are they trained? Parrots?
We're in the bird group tomorrow night. At sunset, all of the bats fly out of the cave we're going to right now, and a colony of swifts fly in, trading places, if you will. There are supposed to be 300,000 or 400,000 of them. The swifts have adapted to living in the cave and hang on to the stalactites like they were tree branches. This is the only place in the world this happens, I've heard. We bought some ultra-high-speed film for it. No digital camera for me.
You can come back tomorrow to see the birds if you want, Jenny. I'm not walking back out here again. I'm too old for this nonsense. My blisters have blisters. I'm picking our next holiday. A beach somewhere so I can park my bum. Maybe Hawaii? Or Aruba on some package deal?
The river practically butted up against the path as they made their way. They stopped at a collection of small huts, one of which offered concessions, another of which shaded a dock. It was 30 more baht per person for the bamboo raft ride to the cave. Luartaro and Anya were the first couple on board. Zakarat used a pole to edge the raft away from the bank.
Not deep here, but it is wide. Taking this raft is better than wading, yes? Stay dry by taking this raft. The Shan tribe provides the rats and gets the bat here. That is good.
He pointed to a woman and child near one of the huts.
Tourism money has cut the Shan's need for slash and burn rice farming. That is very good.
Are you a member of the Shan tribe?
Yes. All the people in my tribe respect the caves and their creatures. The birds, bats, fish, and snakes. The tourists who come to see the caves are helping our community.
The raft floated with the current for several minutes before Zakarat pulled it to a stop against the opposite shore and motioned his passengers to get off. A young boy collected a few more bot from everyone. The cave loomed sharply to the right, and Zakarat took the lead and gestured to a half-dozen crude wooden steps that had been built next to the entrance.
Follow me, please.
Anya took the first spot in line and was quickly swallowed by a cavern filled with stalagmites, small sinkholes, and vents. The change in temperature hit her immediately. The air was cool from her knees down, closest to the ground. Above that, it remained warm and humid. The light had changed, too, and Anya closed her eyes for a moment. When she opened them, they had adjusted better to the dimness. She looked up, but couldn't see the ceiling. It was lost in overlapping shadows dotted with the tips of stalactites.
Cave elephant.
Zakarat pointed to a formation of rock and limestone that had been fashioned by water dripping across it through the centuries. Anya could make out the broad shape of it and the outline that could be construed as ears and a trunk.
Cave dog. Cave monkey.
Zakarat pointed to other limestone formations that were not quite so easy to make out.
Cave crocodile.
The eco-wife pointed to one that looked like a snake and snapped a picture of it. Anya shielded her eyes as the woman took another picture and then another, the flash in the darkness almost painful in its sudden brightness. She took several more shots of other formations in rapid succession and of the natural limestone columns that extended 20 meters or more to the ceiling.
So it's called a spirit cave because of the animal spirits that fill it, right? Spirits in the lime, I guess you could call them.
Spirits of dead animals. No, some of the local tribes claim that the souls of the human dead live here. That is why it is called a spirit cave. Those tribes, but not the Shan, will not come here. They fear for their lives. Some other tribes, they are not so superstitious. It is these tribes, but not the Shan, that stole most of the artifacts that were here. But there are some pieces not so good for you to see. I'll show you.
The group edged deeper into the cave. Bats, hidden by the shadows, made their presence known. Zakarat picked up a gas lantern from the floor and lit it. The bats became more vocal as the light grew brighter. A mud-colored snake slid across the path and toward the wall.
This is all so beautiful.
Yes, though not so beautiful as you.
They both stared at the immense chamber, striped with earth colors and shining in the meager light. No matter how many caves Anya had traipsed through, she never really tired of them and was always amazed by what magnificent formations nature had sculpted. Anya felt relaxed in the cave, though she knew from their mannerisms that some of her companions, the Australian husband in particular, were made uneasy by the surroundings. They walked on, following the bobbing light of Zakarat's lantern. Anya could hear moving water a few minutes before they reached another river, or perhaps a branch of the same one. Zakarat indicated another bamboo raft.
More bats, right? For the Shan.
Zakarat pulled them across to the far side of the cave.
Follow me, please.
Zakarat led them up a fairly steep rise to a ledge that overlooked a cavern.
Whew, no rails. We've been to quite a few caves. Not near the safety standards as in Carlsbad Caverns and Mammoth Cave, or even that Mark Twain one in Missouri. They all had railings.
Zakarat's course took them around a deep sinkhole and to another chamber from which tunnels branched away. Scattered road cones and faded danger signs blocked off a few of the passages, and Anya suspected there was a risk of cave-ins. Another sign, more recent from its bright paint, dangled from a rusty chain. It read, "Do not pass. Low oxygen." Zakarat pointed to a spot midway up the wall.
See here. Cave painting. Authentic. One of seven in this cave. But the only one I can show you today. Most paintings are where it is under excavation. Archaeologists from Bangkok found a skeleton under a rock shelf, supposed to be 20,000 years old. The oldest skeleton found in northern Thailand. The dig is off limits, and the skeleton predates the coffins you will see. But this cave painting you can look at. Do not touch, though.
Anya squinted to make out a faded design. At first glance, it looked like a shadow or a smudge. Beneath it, affixed to the stone, was a large black-and-white photograph of what the painting had looked like before tourists had rubbed it away by touching it. The photograph clearly showed a deer, an arrow, and the sun overhead.
There's writing on the photograph. A date. Huh. This photograph was taken 30 years ago.
Pity that people have to ruin things. Inadvertent or no, people don't understand how precious the past is. I wonder what the artist was like. He or she probably painted it with burned bamboo. A lot of bamboo still grows around here.
The cave paintings off-limits today are in better condition. Perhaps it is why they stay off-limits.
Zakarat led them up a damp slope, then down, stepping over and through pools of water and past columns that dripped with moisture and glimmered like jewels in the gaslight. They walked down a set of rickety wooden steps, and they reached the river again.
A beach, I say. That's where we're going next. With a book in one hand and a drink in the other. I'll sit on my bum and soak up the sun. Aruba, I think. Or maybe Jamaica. Oh, rum and cola from a bottomless glass with one of those paper parasols in it.
Zakarat pushed the raft into a darkness that his small lamp couldn't keep at bay. Bats from high overhead fluttered their wings. The air turned thick with the smell of guano.
Oh, God, the stink! It's incredible! I can't believe we paid to smell stuff like this!
The eco-wife doubled over. Her husband hunched too and held his stomach.
It is the bat droppings. That is what stinks so bad. Thousands of bats. Probably hundreds of thousands. Far more than were in the other chamber. Amazing. Ugh, the smell is truly amazing.
Amazingly awful.
Anya could tell that even he was affected by the intense smell. She cupped her hand over her nose and mouth and tried not to gag. Her stomach roiled. She'd been in caves many times before, but none of those had such a large bat population. Their guide seemed inured to it. She was grateful when the raft docked, and Zakarat took them up an incline and through a short tunnel that opened into a chamber filled with what looked like coffins. Though musty and close, the air was considerably better here. No bats were present.
As I mentioned before, the tribe not afraid of this place stole from it. Stole from this chamber and others. Stole some of our history.
Zakarat turned up the lantern, and more details were revealed. The coffins were hollowed-out teak logs ranging from 7 to 9 feet long and were relatively well-preserved.
The pamphlet said they date back at least 2,000 years.
The logs had been intricately carved, and one had deep designs of leaves and vines on it. There were heavy pottery remnants, too.
The tribes no doubt stole all the good, intact pieces of pottery.
Perhaps they'd also stolen the bodies, as Anya couldn't see a single bone left behind. She shuddered as she stepped close to the largest coffin, as if a cold wind had just whipped across her skin. Her skin prickled, as if tiny red ants were crawling over her. Were there real spirits here? Were they trying to tell her something? Perhaps they were upset at the presence of tourists who had come to disturb their eternal rest. Maybe they were angry that their remains and relics had been stolen and were seeking justice or retribution. She could provide neither for them. Sometimes she had an innate sense that something was wrong or that a problem needed addressing. She'd thought it came from inheriting Joan of Arc's legacy and the sword, but she'd eventually realized it was more than that. Even when she was growing up in the orphanage in Louisiana, she'd had an uncanny knack for knowing when things were amiss or when something untoward was about to happen.
What? What is wrong here?
What? I did not catch what you said, Anya.
Zakarat, are there more chambers here with coffins?
Not here, in this cave. Not anymore. But there are other spirit caves nearby in this very mountain range. Many more coffins in them. Sahin, Tukta. There is a place called Spirit Well, too. But part of it collapsed and it is not safe. But this cave, Namlord is easiest on the feet and easiest to reach. This is where I take the tourists. It has some of the best limestone formations. Beanmont Cave, too, has deep coffins. Many, many more coffins there. Pinya and Bullcrack, too. Not so easy as this to get to. More climbing and squeezing.
But you've been there.
Yes. I've taken a few people there. To Pinya and Bullcrack and Beanmont. But only a few. And that was quite some time ago. There are maps you can buy with directions to how to get there, but I'm better than a piece of paper. I'm a very good guide.
Take us there, please. To Pinya and Piman. Take me to see more of these coffins. How many baht, Zakarat, for you to take me?
Us.
Take us to Pinya and to Piman and Tukta and wherever else there are more of these coffins. Places tourists don't go.
You're crazy.
Not easy going like this place. We would need a little equipment for steep places. Not much, some ropes and pitons, a safety line, helmets, maybe a pulley.
Do you?
Yes, I have some caving equipment. My father and I used to.
How much?
500 baht.
Done.
H.
Fine.
Plus extras, maybe. And I will pack a lunch and water bottles for all of us. No charge for the lunch or water.
When can you take us there?
Tomorrow morning. Very early, we should start. The day I have free. And tomorrow night, I take tourists to the bird show. So we have to be back before sunset. We could get in two caves, I think.
You're not taking us to the bird show. Even though I've bought the film, I'm tired. And God knows I can't stand this stink.
The limestone caves that you want to go to, they are off any regular path, as I said.
I understand. Lou and I are in good shape. Climbing will not be a problem.
I can see that you are in good shape. Tomorrow morning, very early, we will leave. When the sun rises. Very, very early. So we have time to see a lot. As the saying goes, I will give you your money's worth.
You don't mind, Lou? Going to more caves?
I would have suggested it if you hadn't. This is fascinating. And I love caving. Too many people have touched these. Too many people don't respect the past.
It's not that. It's not a matter of respect. It's a matter of ignorance. Too many people just don't know any better.
Anya searched the shadows, thinking she saw movement. A spirit, perhaps. Something half-glimpsed, or maybe just imagined. Something that was tugging her or begging her to solve some mystery. She decided in the end it was just the play of Zakarat's light. Still, the troubling cold sensation wouldn't leave her. What was bothering her? What could possibly...
Did you hear that, Jenny?
Hear what? Oh, I heard it. Thunder. The man at the hotel desk mentioned there might be rain today.
Rains come unexpected this time of year. It is almost our rainy season. Time to leave. Let us hope it doesn't rain too much. The path will be muddy and slippery.
Anya was the last in line this time, taking one final look at the coffins and the shadows. And feeling a stronger shiver go down her spine. Outside, it was pouring. It had rained steadily through the night and was still raining the next morning, though it had turned to a drizzle by the time Anya and Luartaro met their guide outside the lodge. She'd put her palm-sized digital camera and extra batteries in a plastic bag and shoved them in her back pocket for insurance against the weather. Zakarat, in the same outfit as the previous day, though with sturdy hiking boots, looked smaller, with his wet clothes hanging on him and hair plastered against the sides of his face. He looked sadder, too, eyes cast down at the puddle between his booted feet, the ball of his right foot twisting in the mud.
If you do not want to go because of the rain, I understand. It rained hard last night and long. Still going, maybe going all day. The trail would be sloppy and the river swollen. I do not have another free day until early next week. I can take you then.
We'll be gone in a few days. Me back to New York. But I don't mind the rain, Zakarat. Maybe Lou does, though, and...
I like the rain fine. When I was a young boy, I used to be afraid of storms. But my mother told me that rain is just God washing away some of man's dirt. Rain makes the world... clean again. And God knows I want these few days to last forever. 500 baht, right? Each? How about 6? No, let's say 7 because of the rain. And that covers all the extras along the way. Half now? The other half when you drop us back here?
700 each.
Zakharat pointed to an old rusting jeep which had packs and helmets in the back and 2 coils of rope. He'd come prepared in the event the rain had let up or not deterred them.
Besides, it'll be cozy and dry inside the caves.
Luartaro gallantly waved an arm to let Anya into the front seat. He climbed in the back.
You think this is a lot of rain? This is nothing compared to our monsoon season. Good for you that the monsoon season is a few weeks away, because Thailand sits between 2 oceans. We have either downpours or cool and dry weather. Wet now, but the jungle and the mountains are prettiest.
Zakharat drove part of the way, the tires of the jeep easily churning through mud that was several inches deep in places. The rain both muted and intensified the colors, and the scenery reminded Anya of chalk sidewalk paintings in Brooklyn that ran like impressionist watercolors during spring showers. It was a wonderful blur of green that she found beautiful, and she drew the scents of the flowers and leaves deep into her lungs and held them as long as possible.
Which cave first?
Bingya. It is older than Nam Lod, and perhaps has the most to see. It is the same mountain range, and they are not terribly far apart, but it is harder to get to. Then Bokrai or Biman, as I think I remember how to get there. We'll have time for at least 2, maybe a 3rd, as it is certain the lodge has canceled my bird show group tonight. The tourists do not want to walk through all the mud.
Pity. That's too bad about your birding group.
Anya had heard of Nam Lod Cave even before Luartaro had looked this area up on the internet. But Pingya and Bokrai were new to her. Although a part of her was excited at the prospect of seeing something that an average tourist never would, she couldn't shake her worries over the mysterious sensation that niggled at her brain.
What? What bothers me?
She'd been to Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, which one of her companions yesterday had mentioned. It had more than 300 miles of tunnels, and she'd walked most of them during her many visits. 3 years earlier, in California, she'd explored a series of caves created in ancient times by volcanoes and earthquakes. And of course, she'd been through the Carlsbad Caverns, which was famous because one of its chambers was larger than 12 football fields. In France, she'd climbed through the Lascaux Cave that featured paintings that dated back about 17,000 years. Older still, by as much as 50,000 years, some scientists estimated, were the fossils of bears and other creatures found in Poland's dragon's lair. On the island of Capri, off Italy one summer, she'd journeyed through the Blue Grotto, a 4-mile-long cave with breathtaking formations. Her favorite cave? She thought about it a moment as the jeep jostled along the road, which was little more than a puddle-dotted path. Perhaps the one in the Austrian Alps, Eisriesenwelt, in the Tennengebirge range, one of the world's largest ice caves. Or maybe the Pierre Saint-Martin cave that stretched from France to Spain, one of the deepest recorded. In Australia, for a Chasing History's Monsters special, she'd made a side trip to the Naracoorte caves, but found them disappointing. The caves were largely a collection of big sinkholes. Her trip was salvaged when she went to the Waitomo Caves in New Zealand. That had been her favorite, she decided, after a few more moments of contemplation, because of the worms. The same way Zakharat had pulled their group along the river on a bamboo raft in Nam Lod Cave, the New Zealand guide had taken her group in a flatboat into Waitomo. At various points in their half-hour excursion, the guide had doused the lights. A riot of shimmering stars had appeared overhead. Except they weren't stars. They were glowworms. Anya had counted herself fortunate that day to have seen something so unique and glorious. She continued to run the names of caves through her head. Ones she'd been to, ones she had no intention of visiting, and ones she would like to see while she was still young. She couldn't recall the name of the cave system in China that was perhaps the longest in the world. That was on her must-see list. The mental activity was a reasonable distraction to keep the chill away.
She'd gotten goosebumps again the minute she'd sat in Zakharat's jeep, and the sensation of ants crawling on her skin had worsened as they'd headed down the road. It wasn't the rain and the cool breeze that came with it. The sensation was from something else. Maybe, she wondered, the ill feeling had nothing to do with the limestone caves or the spirits of the dead that had been interred in the teak coffins, but instead about their guide. Worse, what if her nerves were jangling because of Luar Taro? Was either of the men in danger? Or dangerous? Would Rue know what was troubling her? No, it's the caves, she thought. Maybe not the caves themselves, but something in the mountains. Her mind touched Joan's sword, her sword. It waited for her. But it would have to wait for quite some time, she thought. It had no place in her vacation, especially with Luar Taro around. She didn't want him to see that part of her life. Still, its presence reassured her. The jeep slid to the side of the trail, the front bumper coming to rest against an acacia tree as mud flew away from the back tires. The jolt jarred Anya into alertness. The trail they'd been bouncing along had suddenly disappeared, as if the jungle had reached out and swallowed it. Zakharat turned off the engine, pocketed the keys, and grinned at Anya.
The rest of the way we go on foot. God is washing away a lot of man's dirt today. Good thing you two wore boots today. And a good thing it does not rain inside the caves. We can dry out quickly inside.
Zakharat eased out of his seat and slogged to the back, fitting the largest pack over one shoulder and a coil of rope over the other. He put on one of the helmets so he would not have to bother carrying it. Luar Taro took another pack and the second coil of rope, also putting on a helmet, and gallantly leaving Anya the smallest pack to carry. The rain was coming down harder, thrumming against the hood of the jeep. It splattered against the big leaves and the mud and her shoulders, then against the helmet she put on. Anya fell in behind Zakharat and Luar Taro and continued to listen to the rain.
You walk fast. Good thing that. It leaves more time for the caves and less time in the mud. Most people, the tourists, they don't walk so fast as you.
Anya noted that Zakharat was in good shape, no doubt from walking so many miles daily to take tourists to Nam Lod. She could have easily outpaced him, though. She was in that much better condition. He had told them that the last time he brought a few people this way, it had taken nearly 2 hours to reach the first cave. They managed it in less than one. The mountains loomed before them. The rock face they started to climb was slick from the rain. As Anya worked her fingers into a crack, slid her foot sideways to find a purchase, she thought to herself that this was why the typical tourist was not directed this way. Her foot slipped, and she teetered, held in place by just the tips of her fingers and willpower. She fought for balance and slowly righted herself, pressing tight against the cold, wet stone. The rock felt good against Anya's fingers. Her muscles bunched as she pulled herself up behind Luar Taro. The exertion was welcome. Even the thrill of almost falling was welcome. It brought a slight flush to her face and chased away the unnatural cold that had been teasing at her gut. The first chamber was nearly 300 feet above the jungle floor. It was a tight fit to step inside, though from the rock face it had looked to have been larger in earlier years. An earthquake or rock slide had narrowed it. Luar Taro had to shrug off his backpack before he could slip in. Once past the opening, Zakharat lit a gas lantern and passed Anya a dented flashlight.
In case. You shall always carry a flashlight in case something happens to the lantern.
I have one too, a flashlight, and some extra batteries. So, tell us about this particular cave. I find all caves fascinating.
50 years ago, a United States man came to my country to study plants. Plants, of all things, led to this discovery. The man was studying the Hobbinian people who lived in this area in ancient times and who were said to favor limestone caves. The United Statesman thought they domesticated. He thought they had farmed not just gathered vegetables and fruits, but planted them, and domesticated animals. The Hobinian, my father taught at the university when I was young, taught history, and so I know all about the Hobinian because he taught me too.
My father was also a teacher, archaeology. I followed in his footsteps, so to speak. He still teaches, guest lecturing mostly at schools and universities in Argentina and Chile.
You are an archaeologist?
For quite a few years. Her too, a famous one. She's on TV. She is the star of Chasing History's Monsters. Ever see it?
Oh. The United States man found this very cave. Burma, we are not far from Burma here. Were it not raining, you might see a stream outside through that crack on the other side. Burma is past it. Supposedly the stream was a river in ancient times, and the Hobinian hunter-gatherers lived by it, and lived in this cave.
Still listening to Zakarat, Anya strolled near the closest cave wall. It was covered in drawings of pigs and birds, and a trio of images that looked like two-legged lizards. The shifting light from the lamp made it seem as if the figures were moving. Though faded, they were in far better condition than the smudge she saw in Nam Lod cave.
The American 50 years past found plants. Beans, peas, peppers, something like a water chestnut, cucumbers, and gourds. All fossilized in this cave.
Anya knew that with a map, she and Luartaro could have likely found this cave with little trouble on their own. But she was glad to have Zakarat with them, providing information about the ancient plant discovery.
Carbon dating placed all the fossils at roughly 8,000 BC. There have been stone tools, too, which were quickly housed in a museum in Bangkok, as well as remains of small animals that suggested the primitive people were not so primitive after all. They roasted their meat, maybe in containers of green bamboo, a method still used throughout Thailand.
Zakarat led them into a tight passage with a roof barely 6 feet high.
They found pots and pieces of pots, some made with woven cords to make them stronger, some with evidence that they were used over a fire. Found lots of tools. My father called them adzi, and they were polished, these tools. You know, the Chinese learned how to polish stone tools from us. Not the other way around.
Zakarat stopped when the passage forked, one root rising steeply, the other passage twisting down at a sharp angle.
It has been quite some time since I took people here. I'm not sure.
I vote for down. If it's wrong, we can backtrack and take the other one.
Same here.
Down then.
Zakarat led the way with Anya right behind him. The rock was so thick she could no longer hear the rain, and they were going deeper still. She tried to imagine what living in these caves must have been like centuries upon centuries ago, without such modern conveniences as flashlights and Zakarat's gas lantern. Their course leveled off, then descended again. The passage became so low they had to crawl. Water covered the floor by several inches. Anya was struck by the stink of patches of guano that floated on the cold air. The floor was alternately squishy and slick with mud, and she struggled to keep her face and shoulders out of the water. Farther, and the air became heavy and saturated with water, the smell of mud hitting her like a wall.
Underground rivers in these mountains. Maybe they are rising because God needs to wash away still more dirt.
The rock floor was sharp in places, evidence that few people came this way, and it bit into Anya's legs through her now soggy jeans. Despite it being summer, it was cool in there, and she wished she'd brought a jacket.
My sister is terribly claustrophobic. My sister, she wouldn't... What is the American expression?
Be caught dead in here?
See, yes, be caught dead. Here or in any of the other caves I've been to. Still, you'd like her, my sister. I hope you get the chance to meet her. Even though she is claustrophobic, you would get along.
Caught dead, Anya froze. She felt certain that whatever was bothering her had something to do with death.
Free me!
She twisted in the tiny space, looking left, then right, then back over her shoulder. Was someone there? Sakarat kept crawling ahead, dragging the lantern with him, the jostling and sloshing of the base of it in the water sending shadows dancing maniacally across the walls and reflecting off the wet stone. He was careful to keep as much of it out of the water as he could. If it got too wet, it would go out. Fortunately, the lantern had a reflector in it, which made its light fairly bright. Anya felt an icy jab rise up from her knees. Had she heard something, or was her imagination dancing in time with the shadows?
Something wrong? Something I said?
No, Lou. Nothing's wrong.
Anya hurried to catch up to their guide.